Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Take a walk on the wild side and just keep walking till you come to the place where the wilderness begins. Then take a giant leap of faith into the wild lands and free fall your way into the Great Spirit. And when you return, your pockets are filled with the golden nectar of divine revelation. When we continue our quest of the spiritual values of the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness, it's here on the Wild Side News. A small group of men entered the Boundary Waters Canoe Area in northern Minnesota, one of the world's great wilderness places, as they opened the Book of Nature to explore the spiritual values of the Boundary Waters Canoe Area. One of those men was Greg Fitzhausen. Our discussion continues.
Let's start to explore what it is that you and your fellow voyageurs discovered in this quest.
I guess I could use examples from the statement that we've drafted. We sort of are trying to reach towards some principles of a theology of wilderness, you might say. And the first one that we list is that the wilderness is a place to learn about God. Wilderness is a place that nurtures spiritual formation. And some of this is based on our reading of a passage in the book of Romans that says, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that we are without excuse. And what that suggests is that God's invisible qualities, the things we always try to put our understanding, wrap our understanding around God, but if there's one thing that's not ultimately knowable or graspable and keeps us coming back for more, it's the nature of God. It's the nature of existence. And yet, the qualities of God are able to be perceived in what has been created. And this is a real touch point for a group like ours to realize that all of creation can teach us something about God and can deepen our own sense of our faith. As, similar sort of to a comment that was made by St. Thomas Aquinas, and he said something along, I paraphrase, he said something along the lines of that no one thing in creation could fully reflect the glory of God, and that is why we have the diversity of all things in creation, that they might better reflect the glory of God. And this is some of the kind of appreciation I think that we're striving for, is to understand that we can learn of the way things are through what God has created. We can learn of who God is through what God has created, and it can lead us to praise God even more. So that's one of the learnings that we drew out of this time.
Let me ask you something too, on a very personal note. What was the experience of experiencing or coming to know? What did you sense? How did you sense these connections?
Interesting. It's a little bit like trying to explain how you come to know some of the most important but yet intangible things in your life. It's a little bit like love. It's a little bit like those deepest things we believe, which are hard to, we can't control them in some ways, and yet we believe them and we benefit from them. I guess if I had to explain how I came to know or feel that, I could describe a couple of the instances, a couple of the exercises. One of the exercises we did was to take a time of silence, silent meditation. And part of an exercise like that is opening up to just the experience of being. Our lives, especially in this culture, are so saturated with doing, 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 achieving, making, and being constantly busy and fixing things and all that. But just to stop and to be, especially in a place like the Boundary Waters that is so quiet and the solitude is of such an excellent sort, this opens up a time of feeling, of knowing, in a sort of a whole being kind of way, the presence of God, just being surrounded by God's presence and by the sense that my place in this grand creation, although I am just a tiny, tiny little speck. I mean, the wilderness can make you quite humble in realizing how small you are. But I think there's also this sense of being embraced, nonetheless, in the warmth of God's love, that in some way is communicated through a perception of God's presence. But I don't know. That's the kind of thing that's there all the time. But in the busy, everyday humdrum of our lives, we often don't stop to take notice of it. So I think that's one of those times where some of the exercises that we intentionally did in the wilderness helped us to experience and encounter the blessings of a spiritual experience that resonates with our faith.
I'm going to push this even a little farther, because I think this is critical. You mentioned two words, feeling and knowing. Those are two ways of getting a message. When we feel something, I'm curious, from this is very personal, yeah. But how, first of all, how would you, and or where would you feel that, and how would you sense that was important? And then the second dynamic is, at the same time, knowing, how would that information come into your cognizance? So let's start with the feeling. Where or how would you feel that?
These are big questions, and I'm not sure I can really give an adequate answer. But for myself personally,
that I think is how it happens.
Yeah, exactly. We are earthy, and what part of what I feel and know has to do with my senses, with my physical senses, with the slowing down of my breathing, with the calm that enters into me, with the relaxation of my muscles, with attuning the rhythm of my breathing to the sound of the waves or of the wind, and starting to be aware of things other than myself. Somehow enriches my own being. I'm going to resort to a sense of what I think is going on. This is my belief about what's going on. I think the very nature of reality is relational. And so what we feel has to do with what we're relating to. And so often we're so wrapped up in our own agenda, in our own ego, and what we want for ourselves, that we don't really pay attention to other things. So in a space like that, when you actually start to stop and feel the rest of creation, stop and feel the other people you're with and what's really going on for them, it opens up a whole new dimension of our own selves, of our more real selves, ourselves in relation to all the rest of the world. So I think that part of that feeling is very directly just the literal feeling of relationship to other things, physically, and memories that are in my mind of what we paddled through yesterday, or the conversation I had with David in the canoe, or whatever it might be. These are all things that add to this of what I'm feeling. As for how that translates into knowledge, we're a little bit handicapped, I think, in this culture. In perhaps ever since the Enlightenment, there's been this notion that the rational mind is the seat of true human being, and that our sort of cognitive rationality, if you will, is all that matters. And of course, that's a very, very important kind of knowing and a kind of knowledge. It's the basis of the natural sciences. And so the things that we can know and can experiment with and can deduce are very important and very powerful, and have led to all kinds of discoveries and important understandings of the way the world works. But that's not the only way that we know. I think there really is something, that there is a sort of an embodied kind of knowing that is available to human beings, that is the integration of our feelings and our emotions with our rational cognitions. And for instance, for the Greek Orthodox Christian tradition, this is what theology really is. Some will say that in the last 100 years, the study of theology has sort of lost its way because it's just a bunch of words of people talking about God and talking about what God's supposed to mean. Whereas real theology, say according to the Greek Orthodox, would be what we can say of God based on our common experience of God. And what that means is that we've had intuitions. What that means is that we've had mystical experiences. And these may not be the kinds of things that we can repeat or control, or duplicate with some or with some kind of scientific precision so that we could prove it in a rational, cognitive kind of way. But these are the things that we know, we seem to know and trust more deeply than anything else. And it's those things that we connect with, the cognitive things we know, the things we see, the things we can repeat. And I think it's in the integration of what we know intuitively, mystically, with those things that we know more rationally, that we have a more full kind of human knowing. And a wilderness setting is an ideal place to help generate that. Kathleen Norris has written a great book about her time in a Benedictine monastery, and she talks about Gregorian chant and how that neurologists have discovered that the kind of pace every 2 to 4 seconds of a mantra or of a chant, similar to the sound of waves lapping on the ocean shore, has an effect in the human brain of connecting our right and left hemispheres a little bit better, of helping them integrate. And I think that there may be some connection here. This kind of peace that we find and this sense of greater knowing things may in part come from getting into those rhythms, the rhythms of nature, and in our case, even the rhythms of our spiritual disciplines that help integrate our right and left hemispheres, that help integrate our mystical, intuitive side with our rational side, and yield a fuller kind of full being knowing. And we can speak of it. We can all talk about these incredible experiences we've had in the wilderness, and we all, you know, you and I could sit around and nod, and I know what you're talking about, and you know what I'm talking about. Yet that doesn't mean that we can then write it all down in some kind of formula and claim to control it, and here's how it all works, and we just have to apply this scientific approach to it. There's still something mysterious about it. There's still something in some way transcendent about it, which is what makes it so valuable to us in the first place.
I think we're really making some progress here. It's fun to be able to talk about these things. It feels good.
Yeah.
From my perspective, the way I would interpret this is that the languaging is that we go to the wilderness to experience or find God. And what you've talked about is this process of slowing down and really opening up your senses. And what I find interesting from an intellectual perspective, but also I've also experienced this, is the concept that as we do that, then there is this thing about attunement and harmony. And it, literally in music, for example, there are literal resonances that are based on mathematics. And if we are able to, if you get two strings on a guitar and you pluck them, if they're in harmony with each other, they will start to resonate together. Just the energy will transfer. So this process of slowing down and beginning to listen and starting to try to literally attune yourself to the wilderness, if we see the wilderness as an expression of the divine, then what we begin to do is to resonate with that divinity and therefore become one with, and it's my way of interpreting what I experience.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then as one does that and begins to resonate with this sense of this literal power of divinity, then one can move that into the mind, and there becomes an inner harmony, and that actually is sort of an expression of inner peace, which is a way to interpret God or the divine. Let's go on as well to some of the other
parts of our statement.
Yeah. Correct. Yes. Uh huh.
Well, one of the other points we said was that wilderness cultivates community and friendship. And that has in part to do with the challenges of a wilderness area. We're not able to bring all our modern conveniences with us, thankfully. And we learn to be more frugal, and life is more simple, and things are more essential. And one of the things that was true on this trip that I've noticed over time as well is that you really start to see, you feel more viscerally your need for other people, for what they have to contribute. Your well-being depends more immediately on your cooperation with the other members of your group, and it also depends more immediately on the quality of your environment. You know, harsh weather is a much larger concern. Questions of getting lost and where are we matter. And so we have to pay closer attention to what's really going on, to what life really is in some ways when we're in that kind of space. And so cooperation and community, born of necessity, begin to create for us bonds that take us deeper into the experience. That, like on this trip, for instance, one evening a cookpot got kicked over, and we lost one of our dinners, which presented a problem because we packed very efficiently for our food. And that meant that, well, we did have a couple fishing poles with us, and so we needed to get some fish to have dinner the next night. And there was something about that, you know, people working together on that so that we'd have a good dinner. I suppose we could have also fasted and gone for another kind of a spiritual experience. But there was something of the community coming together and responding to a need and overcoming that challenge together that really is empowering in a lot of ways. And I think this immediacy of being aware of our surroundings and of checking in with one another's well-being is part of this need for being more open to that. And I think that's another one of those kinds of things that can then be linked to some of the insights from our faith tradition. If you think about the Genesis creation stories, where God, in the first chapter of Genesis, God creates each of these things, light and dark, and the plants and the animals. And when God creates and God looks and sees that it's good, each thing is seen to be good, and God charges the different creatures to be fruitful and multiply. Not just humans are charged to be fruitful and multiply, but so too are the other creatures. You know, you think about those kinds of things, and it reinforces for us that part of our task is to encourage the kind of planetary health where all of God's creatures can be fruitful and multiply as God commanded them. I think something like that makes more sense. It's easier to be aware of that, sort of both viscerally, you know, experientially, why that sort of thing is important when you're in the wilderness, where your well-being really does more directly seem to be linked to this interdependence with other people and with the natural world. So that would be another sort of insight that came out of our time and of our community experience.
It's kind of interesting, too, in the sense that ego begins to disappear in the wilderness.
Yeah.
For example, if you have to go out and fish, in a more sort of traditional fishing experience, there's a lot of ego. Well, you got the big fish.
Yeah.
Well, you know. In this particular case, if someone happens to catch the big fish, you're very thankful.
Yeah, that's right.
Because it feeds more people more effectively, and you feel better. So
yeah.
We can, instead of seeing that as sort of a one-upsmanship, you know, going on, it is a sense of, thank God he caught that fish.
Yeah, well, there's a real sense of gratitude that arises out of that. And in fact, in this particular case, that really was true. Our guide went out in a canoe, and he was trolling a lure, and he caught a relatively small bass. And when he saw it as it came up to the boat, he thought, well, that's a pretty small fish. And then suddenly a much larger northern pike grabbed that bass. And suddenly he had a pretty good-sized fish on the line.
Oh, my gosh, that's a great story.
He was able to net both of them in the end. And just as he netted the northern pike, he bit the bass out. So it was just in time. And it was, you know, you get this sense of, holy, you know, there was nothing I could have done. You couldn't repeat that. I can't make that happen every time. That's extraordinary. And there's a little bit of a sense of divine provision there.
Wow.
And he came back with this fish that was large enough to feed us.
That's a great story.
Yeah, so I think that, you know, and that raises another one of our other themes has to do with wilderness being God's gift. A gift is something, you know, what's the appropriate response to a gift? Well, it's gratitude. And if we are thankful for what we have, and we value what we have, then we may be more likely to protect what we have, to cherish what we have. And there's the priest at my wife's parents' church has picked this up out of a sermon he gave one time, and he was talking about gratitude, and what he said was that gratitude turns what we have into enough. Gratitude turns what we have into enough. And I thought that is a truism that we experience out there. When we stop to give thanks for those things that we have, we realize that we have everything we need right here, right now, and more. And that's a powerful and important and could be a very valuable lesson for particularly our culture. When we have so much, or affluence may be one of our problems, we don't seem to know where enough lies. Yet if we have a greater sense of gratitude, if we can give thanks for what we have, maybe that reduces that, whatever that is, that compulsive consumption that we have, that we always seem to want more. So I think that sense of gratitude was a real gift from our time in the wilderness. And I think if you can transfer that to your sense of human gratitude for the gift of creation, for life itself, that's one of the most powerful overall things that maybe our group or groups like ours will take out of a wilderness experience. One little example, Fred, who was leading the trip, took the time towards the end of it to pick up some particular small rocks, sort of palm-sized rocks. And he did that because I have a 13-month-old son who I, couldn't help but talk about while we were on the trip. And Fred decided that my son Eli needed some good rocks from the boundary water that he could check out and play with. And so I came back with a small bag of rocks that Fred had chosen for my son. And now, on the one hand, those rocks are wonderful in and of themselves. I cherish those rocks because they're a part of the boundary waters. They remind me of that experience, and they're fascinating anyway. And my son loves rocks. I mean, we can hardly keep him out of the gravel driveway. He's going to be some kind of a geologist or rock hound someday. But so those rocks are special in and of themselves. But the fact that they're a gift, the fact that Fred picked each one of those by hand to give to my son, makes them something more. That they're not just wonderful rocks that are already a symbol of good things. They are a gift from Fred that adds special meaning to them, that makes them something that I'll cherish even more. And I think that's sort of like the spiritual reality that we're encountering in a place like the Boundary Waters, that the creation and life itself is God's gift, and that's a gift that adds something intangible yet powerfully real to our care for creation.
This is, I was actually really smiling as you said that, because I think this is fascinating to think about, that these rocks that you have now, when you talk about them with your son, have special meaning, special added value, and yet it is, after all, just a rock.
Yeah.
And then you could have another rock from your backyard, and that's a different rock, but these rocks are special. So what it is that those rocks bring, I think, is part of the discovery of the spiritual nature. What is that? I don't know. We have an answer to that, but that's worthy of investigation. What is it that you attach to that rock that then reaches deep and brings on special meaning? And how much you apply? Let's kind of investigate that. What is it about the wilderness? There's lots of wild lands. There's a lot, open forests and, my gosh, public lands and things. But let's talk about what you feel, because you are very specifically talking about the wilderness. Let's talk about that special meaning that wilderness brings that is perhaps a little different than the other lands.
That's a great thing to add. I think before that, though, I should even be clear that in some sense we're all in trouble if the only place where we can get a real special sense of the natural world is in the wilderness. I mean, my son loves playing with rocks in the driveway. He is fascinated by the little cherries on the tree outside, our ornamental cherries that he loves to pull off. The flowers right here at our door stoop are an amazing world of nature to him, and I think that fostering that kind of appreciation in the everyday in our own backyards is critical to our formation as human beings. But yeah, there is this thing about the wilderness. Why did the prophets go to the wilderness? Why did Jesus and his disciples go to the wilderness? Why were the people of Israel formed in the wilderness? It's true in other religious traditions, enlightenment, the Buddha sitting under a tree, right? Or these kinds of metaphors that come out of wilderness experience seem to be perennially important, no matter what your religious perspective is or your philosophy. And I think that's in part because of something about the purity of the wilderness. In the wilderness where humans have had very little presence, very little impact, we see life and creation just as it is, without being confused by what we try to make it or what we might form it into. It's just the purest gift you could imagine. It's just the way it is. It's what's been given to us. We did not make this. It couldn't be anything other than a gift. And I think, you know, that dimension of the wilderness may underlie what makes it such a powerful place. That's beyond just the fact that the wilderness is almost always spectacularly beautiful. I think that goes without saying that one of the reasons we preserve these places is because of their inspirational character, of their beauty. And beauty, if you followed Iris Murdoch at all, that she had this idea of the beginning of the ethical life is an unselfing. Rather than being preoccupied in our own illusions and all the things we wrap ourselves up in, but rather to be unselfed, and one of the beginning places for that to happen is by an encounter with beauty, an encounter with nature, or an encounter with love. These are the places where we become unselfed, and if we can become unselfed like that because of the beauty of nature or of other people or of our intuition of God, then suddenly we have a much better vision of what's really going on in life. We are not the center of the world. We are not even nearly as important as we think. And yet, we are in relationship to all these other things. We are loved, and we are a part of this beautiful, beautiful thing. And that, for Iris Murdoch, was the starting point of the ethical life. And I think that helps explain some of the power of this and some of the potential of this, is that this, for us, can refine us as human beings. It can lead us to better living. And this is something that, you know, has to do with why we have national parks in the first place. There were a number of reasons why the original legislation passed in order to establish some of our early national parks. But one of the important elements that Frederick Law Olmsted would have talked about is that these spectacularly beautiful and scenic places have the capacity to give us an opportunity for contemplative recreation, to inspire, to pull us out of ourselves, and that has a refining quality. And for any nation who is going to be busy about the business of just living and getting by, that refining quality of the wilderness is something worth preserving and protecting and cherishing particularly. There may be other things that we could do in that area. I mean, we can play tennis right next to Bridalveil Falls in Yosemite Valley, but what a silly place to play tennis. You can play tennis anywhere. There are a few places, however, though, where you can be so inspired by the beauty of some of these areas. And that, I think, is the special thing that wilderness areas offer us, is that particular opportunity for that sort of inspiration that you're not going to gain from my front yard.
I thought it was just interesting that you brought up the fact that we must not devalue what is in the yard, and quite honestly, the rocks in the yard. You were talking about your son, and that to me is where I think there's the loop. Yeah. That when we think of the value that wilderness has, this mythical value and its role in what it provides to us spiritually, that perhaps what we can then take is that and begin to apply it to the smaller spaces, to a national park, but as well to that forest behind us, or perhaps the edge of a creek, or again, to really see the wilderness even in our backyard.
I think that's right. I think that's really true. I think that when you experience a particular way of being that is so inspiring, you recognize that this might actually be what life should be more like all the time. You bring a portion of that back with you and incorporate it into the way you meet the world back home. And I think that has to be a hope. That has to be a hope of what the value of a wilderness experience is, because if the only value is in going to the wilderness, then we're all going to descend on our wilderness areas, and we don't have enough of them, and they'll all be trampled. There has to be a balance in terms of our understanding of what the value of these places are, and yet that this wilderness is, in some ways, wilderness is no different than anything else. Other areas are just areas where humans, as part of nature, have shaped what has been made. And it's a very different kind of thing. But if you consider humans wild, then at some level, you can see the wilderness even in our cities and towns. And I think there's a radical form of value in that that at least is worth thinking more about.
You know what I think is really exciting about this particular conversation? And that is, I feel like I've been there.
Yeah.
In the process of sharing these thoughts, I just took a journey to the wilderness sitting here in my studio in San Diego. That's pretty powerful. So at the end of all of this, then in terms of the process of the opening the book of nature, let's discuss what then happens, and then I also want people to find out how they can learn more about this. So let's do that.
Yeah, well, so in our case, you know, we say this understanding that we've been coming to, and that you and I can talk about, and it resonates with us, and we'd like to go further with this. One of the things, this is a value that probably more Americans share than we realize, but we don't usually take the time to make it explicit. And, you know, even in the story of the national parks, probably this element of contemplative recreation maybe hasn't been emphasized enough, and that's why we have such a need for wilderness areas. And so that next step that we're taking is to try to be explicit about some of these values and write them down. And it's been basically a process of editing, and we had different people that were actually taking notes on that whole trip and trying to jot down some of the insights and ideas that we were coming up with. And we've taken that material in the meantime and drafted this statement, which the hope is that it can be given to area churches in the Boundary Waters area itself. This is the kind of statement that can be passed around to make people more aware of some of the efforts that are being made to draw more attention to the spiritual value of the area. Something that might then connect people who haven't traditionally been allies of wilderness preservation might actually draw them into that work, realizing that there are some important spiritual values here that might be a resource for them in their own church or their own community. The hope is, I think, that a statement like ours can invite more people in by communicating some of what we experienced and maybe generating some of that same kind of resonance that you and I are having here on the phone to want to get involved in this. And I think you'd have to get better details from Fred on this, but I think that's happened in many cases with some of the other statements. There was one in New Mexico on Otero Mesa that led to the local bishop writing a letter that had some political ramifications, and they had another one in North Carolina that has led to some initiative in West Virginia now about mountaintop removal and opposing some of the mountaintop removal coal mining that's going on. And so there's sort of a ripple effect, hopefully. It's never the same, I don't think. And again, it's not something you can absolutely predict. But I think the hope is that by voicing something that is, well, back to the idea of what's theology, is something in common that we do experience, we are hoping to voice something that other people may know, but it hasn't been made explicit before. And if we can resonate with the things that others hold dear and value and cherish from within our own faith commitments, then we can maybe activate a similar, a larger community of care for creation. That, I think, is, you know, sort of what we're hoping for, is that this statement, by just being a faithful statement of the insights and the inspiration that we gain, if it can connect with other people and encourage them to delve into this some more themselves, and if we can make connections with other efforts, we can begin to reinforce one another and build a larger community for conservation based on a broader set of values that can support conservation.
Greg, for people who want to know more about the specifics, what's the best way for them to do so?
Well, the webpage for the Religious Campaign for Forest Conservation, www.creationethics.org, I think that's right. And there is a link there to the Opening the Book of Nature program, and to some of the other initiatives that have been going on similar to this. So that's one way. I think you can also find out there about some of the other wilderness statements that have been drafted from around the country. And there are also links there to other religious environmental organizations. For anyone with a broad interest in how some of this is playing out, there are a whole manner of different resources on the World Wide Web at this point that can point or can sort of paint a picture for what other religious communities are doing and some of their success stories and those kinds of things.
We're talking with Greg Fitzhausen, who is a doctoral candidate at Cornell University. This has been a really wonderful conversation, and we'll continue in variations on this theme into the future. Greg, I want to thank you for lending your voice to the Wild Side News.
Thank you very much, Sydney. The conversation was my pleasure.
And from the boundary waters of Minnesota, we now head down a bit to the shores of Lake Michigan, to the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore, when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.